Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Alcohol Tipping Point podcast. I am your host, Deb Meisner. I am a registered nurse, a health coach, mom, and alcohol-free badass. And today I have Eric Riaz on the show. He is a men's coach and interventionist. He has his own podcast called Hearts Over Everything, and he is the owner of Big Mood Mental Health, which is also a sober advocacy group. So welcome, Eric, to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I appreciate you, Asha.
Thank you for being on here. Tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay. So I'm a Queens, New York native. I ended up in California in 2013 in order to get clean from a heroin addiction and alcoholism. And when I made it out here, I started personal development. You know, I was a 12-step guy, so I started, you know, working 12 steps and learning some new principles about life. I was a fitness guy, so I started, you know, learning that every day, if I put one foot forward, eat right, work out, my body and my life changed. And that just became a metaphor for life. I just kept going, kept getting certifications, kept getting trainings, and became, you know, went from, you know, coaching modality to coaching modality, kind of just enhancing what I do. So it was like fitness and health and wellness and health and lifestyle and mindset. Then it went to life and the life coaching and mentorship and mentoring kids. And now I over the last 6 months, I've really been called to work with men only. To accentuate and to, evoke the healthy masculine within a recovery setting and within the healing space. So I'm a men's coach and men's mentor. And then I do interventions for men as well. I used to work with men and women, but now it's, I've really been called to support the healthy masculine right now. And maybe I'll go back to working with women one day, but yeah. And the sober advocacy portion is what we do on the podcast and what we do with, you know, I work with clients and families of loved ones who are not prepared to go to treatment just yet. So I work with families over time, sometimes 9 months, sometimes 2 months to get their loved one into treatment and off the street usually. And I get to advocate for the family and for the loved one and really work with the families closely and hear the tragedy of the moms and, deeply how it affects the family, you know? So that's really what I do. That's kind of the progression of how I got here.
Yeah. So you kind of cover all, aspects of recovery from the individual to the family and friends that are impacted by it, sounds like.
Absolutely. I have a soft spot for the moms, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember one of my worst memories of my addiction was hearing my mother cry after finding me, you know, in a extremely compromised position. And so I remember that, and I hear the worry in the mom's, you know, voices when I speak to them every day, because I speak to these parents every day, you know, trying to save their, help their children save their own lives, really. I try to cover it all within my company. Any need that needs to be met, hopefully I can meet it, you know, when it comes to supporting addicts, alcoholics, and people struggling with mental health afflictions.
Yeah, that you're really giving back. Can you share a little bit more about your story with addiction?
Yeah. So I started drinking. I always share this, actually, is that I'm a survivor of sexual trauma. Mm-hmm. So I do believe that my sexual trauma led to the immense discomfort that I felt my entire life, you know. I didn't think of it as, and I understand that what happened was wrong, until I was in my 20s. And everything, I normalized it in my head and rationalized it in my head prior to that. But there was an immense discomfort that I felt throughout my entire life. And by the time I was 12 or 13, I was an awkward, you know, young black kid around surrounded by white people, surrounded by white faces, and I just wanted to be a part of. When I took my first drink and smoked my first joint, the playing field was evened, and I felt like we were all on equal footing at that point. Once I put a substance in my body, I don't stop. That's just what makes me a little different. People like me a little different than the average, you know, temperate drinker. I clearly was shown that I drank differently than my friends. And I started to lose friends, you know, people couldn't be around me. I'm also dual diagnosis. I deal with bipolar disorder. So that accentuated that expedited the suffering of my experience. So there's a lot of mental breakdowns within that time, and my substance use progressed, to kind of find what was going to work, what was going to bring the ease and comfort that I so longed for. And I started to find downers, Xanax and Valium and things like that. And then Percocet, and my whole community was hit by the opiate epidemic. Mm-hmm. Very hard. I never did fentanyl. I got sober before fentanyl was a thing. So my community was Oxycontin and Oxycontin 30s and oxycodone and things like that. So we got hit with that pretty hard. People started dying. I got really into selling and doing those in 2009. Like I said, people started dying. And then when the sale of those drugs was limited and it was harder and harder to get, the only logical option was to do heroin, you know, because it was cheaper, more affordable, more accessible. As an addict and alcoholic, it didn't make sense to me that, oh, there's no more of these, I should stop using them. It made sense. Okay, there's no more of these, I should find an alternative. And my alternative was heroin. And I was a heroin addict from about 2011 to 2013. Lost a lot of friends, still losing friends. Almost went to prison and, you know, was fully living the street life and the projects and in New York City. A lot of very cold winters and very cold summers, you know. Mm-hmm. That was what my addiction looked like. And had the opportunity to get sober. I have very loving parents who supported me to getting any treatment, which that's why I love to work with the families, because I come from a family of loving parents who wanted me to get help and supported me in getting help, and were willing to spend any amount of money and to do anything in their power to get me help. And they did, and I took the opportunity, came to California, and the rest is history. And now I do what I do now, and happy ever after. A lot of struggle in between there, a lot of suffering still within recovery, but it uniquely qualifies me to do what I do and have the perspective that I have. I'm well suited to help people, to help people that I help.
Yeah, and congratulations on your sobriety.
Thank you.
So what did you feel like, what do you feel are the unique challenges for men, and even Black men specifically, when it comes to getting help?
Oh, absolutely. I think less now, more than ever, the understanding that we need help. And there's an immense amount of pressure on men that we don't acknowledge. It's just expected that we handle our business, right? But we're meant to provide for our families with an economy that doesn't have that doesn't pay more, but expects us to work more, work jobs that are unfulfilling, raise children, and we're supposed to be present for our children, And we're supposed to do all this easily. It's supposed to be easy and deal with mental health and deal with life and suck it up, you know. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to, and honestly, even no matter how much compassion people say they have, that's still what they expect. That's still what they expect from men. So what my goal is to speak openly and freely about mental health with zero reservation. I speak about my mental health challenges and my mental health experience with zero reservation. So other men can say, hey, me too, or wow, he talks about it. He has no reason not to speak about it. You know, he's open, you know, open book about it. I get to be at least a little bit more open. I get to be permission for other men to share. Mm-hmm. So I think the immense amount of pressure that men are under. And then also, you know, there's the hypersexuality that comes with the stresses of manhood, and come with the cultural conditioning of manhood, where porn and promiscuity are celebrated, and if not celebrated, they're tolerated and accepted by us as men, and by everybody. That, like, you know, everybody watches porn, every man watches porn and masturbates once a day or four times a week, and that's just common, you know, business as usual. And I just think, in my opinion, that it's diminishing the male chi. It's diminishing our energy. It's dimming our light, and it's providing a skewed perspective of what sex really is, and it's teaching our young men a skewed perspective of what sex really is, and it's causing sexual dysfunction, in young people who just, you know, are conditioned. I saw porn for the first time when I was 8 years old, and thought that was normal, you know, just happened to be around, you know, just casually around. So yeah, I see the sex one is a common one for me to think about and discuss, because it's so prevalent, and I saw how badly it destroyed things in my life, you know, just the ego that comes along with that, and the selfishness that comes along with that, and the harm that it causes. So I love to work with men in that regard. But yeah, there's an immense amount of pressure, and there's an immense amount of, you know, dysfunction that we tolerate and that we accept as normal. So those are the unique challenges I see and I like to focus on.
Yeah, those are really interesting and something I haven't thought about before. Like, so you're saying there's like a stereotype for men to be like hypersexual and like prove their manhood through sexuality, and is that what you're saying?
Honestly, that's what I'm theorizing. Mm-hmm. Because if you look at the culture, what men are willing to do, the lies that are willing to be told, and how quickly we were conditioned, and how normal it is to cause harm in order to satiate a carnal urge. Mm. We're willing to just lie to women. Just lie to women casually. And, you know, the whole idea of ghosting, women do that too, but and ghosting and gaslighting and all these things that men do, we go so far to do. And this is something that I've done. So I know, this as far as we're willing to go in order to have some sort of conquest. And it's and part of that, I believe, is a biological need in our 20s that, like, we're meant to put our, you know, we're biologically, if we went into ancient times, we would be trying to put our seed and everything, mm-hmm, in order to continue to populate our community and our village, you know. So there's a biological component, but there's also a component now that we know that we shouldn't be driven simply by our biology, that you know, this culture of manipulation in order to fulfill that biological need, quote unquote, roughly. So I do think there's a level of overcompensation, especially with the level of stress and the difficulty in providing as because men do have a hard time providing these days. Mm-hmm. We do. It's women are becoming more and more independent, which is beautiful. You know, I come from my partner is an independent woman. My son's mom is an independent woman. My mom is a CEO of a corporation, a nonprofit. So I grew up just seeing that. So it's something I love to see, and I believe in reciprocity. But men are being left behind, and the jobs that men are doing that are tough jobs are overlooked or not looked at as quality jobs. You know, so there's a lot of stuff going. There's a lot of pieces going on. And mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, men are not victims. We're not victims. We get to take responsibility for all of this. We get to take responsibility. This is because, you know, there may be circumstances that are out of our control, but we own all of the healing. We own all of the healing. So for me, it's not like, oh, woe is men, because we, even as a Black man, I'm still privileged. Even as a Black man, especially coming from the family I come from, I'm most definitely privileged. But there is we do get to take responsibility for all of the healing that comes along with this. So yeah, sorry to go off.
No, I'm so glad. Like, I want to have other perspectives on my show, and you just and hear from more men and Black men, and so I appreciate having the conversation. And so you talk about toxic masculinity and the pressure of being a man and having to provide and be manly, whatever that looks like, being unique to men, like a unique challenge. And that means not showing weakness or asking for help, especially with addiction or drinking problems.
Absolutely. And also, I say this all the time, it's becoming quite redundant for me to say, but it's a principle that I believe in. I do not think toxic masculinity is the primary problem. I think the absence of healthy masculine leadership is the problem. So many men grew up with fathers who are not emotionally intelligent, who worked and just worked and didn't pay attention and didn't love on their children and were not emotionally available. And men had to do a caricature of what they thought manhood was and manhood is. So we're doing this dance of what the idea of what we think manhood is, which comes out in a toxic manner. But if we had healthy masculine leadership, if we saw men being integral, not cheating on their partners, staying in the family structure, raising their children, empowering their children, loving on their children. Like, for me, I have two boys, and my partner has a son who I will potentially be raising. So there's many children for me, that many young men for me that I get to pour into, and I get to show what masculine can look like. So they don't have to pretend to do a play of what they think masculine is, because it ends up with hypersexuality. It ends up with hyperaggression. Not being able to conduct emotional nature, violence. It comes out in all those ways that it came out for me. And we see it culturally play out. We see it culturally play out in many communities. It's not just the Black community, but it's particular in the Black community. But we see it in every community. So I don't think it's toxic masculinity. I don't think masculinity is the problem. I think it's the absence of the healthy masculine and healthy masculine energy. I'm not talking about genitals. I'm talking about the energies of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it's the absence of that healthy masculine energy that is the issue. So for me, I started men's groups. I have a men's group that meets every other week where men come together, process, men come together. We help the community. We raise money for our community. We come in and we have different facilitators. Each facilitator brings his own emotionally intelligent lesson for the week, and then there's open sharing, and every man in the group gets to share. And I want to open up more and more of those groups all around San Diego and do them online as well, so we can start exemplifying healthy masculine for one another, and for our children. And if you don't have children, if there's a young man who doesn't have children yet, he can see, wow, these fathers are showing up for their kids, you know, and these men are showing up in their businesses with integrity. These men are showing up in their community with integrity. So that's my theory. And I say it all the time, but we blame it all on toxicity. And I don't think masculine is inherently toxic.
Yeah. So important. So I, it was so interesting how you said, like, men are just, and it starts when you're a boy, like you're just doing a caricature of what you think it means to be a man. And sometimes that is getting wrapped up in drinking culture. Are you still there?
Sorry, I put you on mute. Absolutely. That drinking culture, beer culture, and sports culture, mm-hmm, is most definitely, and there's nothing wrong with, if I would say, if you can drink like a normal person, quote unquote normal person, if you can limit yourself occasionally, and drink with moderation, I'm all for it. I'm all for sovereignty. You know, everybody should, if you want to alter your consciousness in whatever way that is, you should be able to, if it's done in a way that's not destructive. Mm-hmm. But there is definitely a beer culture and a drinking culture and a sports culture where men come and quote unquote bond, and also quote unquote, and also drink to excess and fight and destroy and are destructive and not productive. And so I do think absolutely, the trauma of the abandonment of the fathers or healthy male role models lead to a void that needs to be filled, and alcohol usually fills that void. Mm-hmm. Or some sort of substance or sex fills, mm-hmm, that void. Even for a man who's not an alcoholic, it could just be the sex that fills that void.
And so what is healthy masculine leadership and energy? What does that look, ooh, like?
I don't, see, that's so subjective, because I know what it doesn't look like. It doesn't, okay, look like manipulation. It doesn't look like what it looks like is integrity. Mm-hmm. That's, if we could put one word onto it, it's integrity. It's showing up in alignment. Mm-hmm. It's showing up keeping your word. It's showing up and supporting your community and supporting your also not only financially but emotionally. It shows up by us showing up. That's what, in my opinion, the healthy masculine energy. And also it's when I say healthy masculine leadership, I do think leadership is part of the healthy masculine. I think men, we lead naturally, and women also have masculine energy, and women lead as well. And women rise into their masculine and drop into their feminine, and men rise into their masculine and drop into their feminine, hopefully fluidly. You know, that's something I practice, is to be with my partner, to be able to be submissive when need be, so she can be powerful and we can go back and forth. I think there's a healthy dance to be done, but the healthy masculine can look different, but I know what it's not. I know it's not taking advantage of people. I know it's not being there for your children. I know it's not a pissing contest. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that's what it isn't.
Yeah. Wow. So interesting. So going back to your work that you do, with addiction, what would you say are your top tips for anyone looking to change their, I kind of focus on alcohol, like their relationship with alcohol. What would you say, yeah, are your top tips or advice you have for someone?
This is going to sound so crazy. let yourself get desperate. Let yourself get desperate. I wish, with all the addiction that I've seen, personally, professionally, all the people who struggle and all the families I work with, we rob people of their suffering. So we got to let people get desperate. So if we're interrupting someone's suffering when they're not ready, it's not going to click. You know, this has to be done with the desperation of a drowning man. If you're the real alcoholic, right? If you're like the alcoholic that cannot stop and no matter what, if you're the heavy drinker, it's still the same. It's how well do you want to be? That's what a sponsor once told me. She said, Eric, how well do you want to be? How badly do you want to feel better? So first tip is don't rob your loved one of their suffering. And don't rob yourself of your suffering. Keep going until it hurts enough. And then when it hurts enough, I promise you, you'll do what you get to do to shift. So that's probably the biggest number one thing is that Viktor Frankl speaks about the unique opportunity to suffer. That's not missed on me. That's everyone gets their turn. And with alcohol, feel all the pain. And if you're not in pain, and then it's working for you. And if it's working for you, why stop? If you can drink and alter your consciousness and be okay and like really be balanced, then it's working for you. But if it's not working for you, think of that pain and how well do you want to be? And if you want to be well, then you're willing to seek help and you're willing to change behavior.
Yeah, and I just want to maybe emphasize that you don't have to hit rock bottom. But it sounds like, go ahead.
Bottom is different. Bottom is different for everyone. Mm-hmm. And my job is to lovingly interrupt loved ones so that they don't have to hit rock bottom. But in my experience, everyone has to hit a bottom. Their bottom may be emotional, it may be spiritual, it may be homelessness, it may be progression of addiction where it goes from alcohol to substances. But rock bottom is relative. So for me, I've hit some bottoms sober, and those sober bottoms were not homelessness and were not like bankruptcy. They were spiritual bankruptcy. There were places where I was so out of alignment with who I was as a person that I couldn't take it anymore and I had to do something different. And so rock bottom, you know, it doesn't have to be homelessness, but when you start looking in the mirror and you're really not liking what you're looking at, that could be your bottom. You can still have your job, you can still have your kids, you can still have everything. But when you're looking in the mirror and starting to make deals with yourself, lie to yourself, compromise your values in order to rationalize what you're doing, that may be your bottom.
Yeah, that's a good point. Appreciate that. What would be some of your other, well, it's kind of interesting that you brought in family when you were, and I think probably just with your work as an interventionist. So maybe I'll go back to that, like how does that work? What does it mean to be an interventionist? What does that look like?
Hold on one second, let me fix my headphones. What it looks like is loving interruption. That's what it is. It's a loving interruption of the detrimental behavior that's causing the suffering. And we get to, the family and I get to frame all this for the loved one to show that it's not working. Based on results, what's working? Based on results, this drinking is not working for you. We have the whole family together. We have mom, dad, grandma, grandpa, your daughter, your son. We have everybody here to like let you know, and not guilt. We're not guilt tripping anybody. We're writing love letters to our family, and we're saying, hey, we love you so, so, so much. We're watching you destroy yourself, you know, and we're lovingly interrupting that experience. So that's what intervention looks like. That's the best way to put it. It's a loving interruption. It's not a guilt trip. It's never a guilt trip. If they feel guilty and shame, you know, that's part of that bottom, right? That's mm-hmm. part of that bankruptcy, which we want to evoke emotion. So if they feel poorly about themselves, then maybe they should, you know, if you feel, and that's something that I theorized for a long time, as a coach. And it's the same thing with weight loss and with body image. If you look in the mirror and you're like, I don't like what I look like, to a point, if you don't like it enough, then you should change it. And with the intervention, if you're not liking what you're hearing and you're not liking what you're looking in the mirror enough, then I will lovingly provide the resources to get you on a plane that day into a treatment center so you can change your life. I do all of the back end work so you can leave that day and go into treatment. So it's all set up for the family and it's all set up for the loved one to go right from this intervention, right from this loving interruption, right into on a plane with me and into treatment. So that's what an intervention is. It's loving interruption. But there's a whole process we go through. Pre-intervention, we connect with the family, let everybody air everything out, let everybody express themselves, because everybody gets to be heard. Everybody in the family gets to be heard. It's not just about the addiction. Is a family. It's a family disease, and the family gets sorted out. And there's circumstances where sometimes multiple people in the family go to treatment. Sometimes mom goes to CODA meetings, you know, as part of the treatment plan for the entire family, as opposed to just the son or the dad going into treatment. Mom gets to go to CODA, you know, the son gets, kids get to go to Alateen or adult children of alcoholics meetings, you know. So we provide the pre-intervention, then we go into the actual intervention. We do this all quickly within days. Mm-hmm. We do this all quickly within days because that window is short. That window is short. Sometimes you don't need, you know, it doesn't need to be urgent. But I come from the school of thought that if you call for an intervention, that person, especially if it's a drug addiction. If it's drug addiction with fentanyl being what it is, mm-hmm. a person, if someone's addicted to drugs, whether it be meth, Xanax, anything pressed, any press pills, any injection, intravenous drugs, that person can die any day. So it should be done immediately. But alcohol, I think also it's always done quickly for me and with my process. I'm on a plane, I'm with the family on Zoom, and then on a plane, you know, a day or two after doing the intervention. And like I said, the resources are all set up all across the country to get you into a treatment center that's going to take you literally, it's already set up. We're going to go on a plane, rent a car, drive you to the treatment center. You're right there in their care, from my care to their care.
And what has the response been like to the person who's being intervened?
For me, it's most people go, mm-hmm. most people go, but also in like 12 step, they talk about frothy emotional appeal will seldom suffice. And what that means is, oh, so we need you to stop, please stop, please stop, please stop. That doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work a lot of the time. And I understand as an interventionist, that's why I created the advocacy program where we work with the family over months, where we work with the family over an extended period of time if they don't go to the initial intervention. Because they may, the chances that like some interventionists say, oh, well, I have 100% success rate. But then how many leave? How many stay sober? Mm-hmm. And honestly, the numbers are 80% of people who go into treatment and don't stay sober. So they might go to treatment, but they're not. They may not be ready to go to treatment. They may have been guilted, and they may have had the emotional piece that worked. But what stays. And for me, most of the time they go. I've had two people not go out of a number of interventions, but we work with the families sometimes over, I work with families over 9 months to get their loved one into treatment or to get a conservatorship or to get the loved one into better care. And I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to work with the family over a long period of time to get the job done to save their loved one's life.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. Thank you for sharing about that work.
It's interesting. It is interesting. I don't know how it's interesting how I got here. I just wanted to be a personal trainer with a full schedule. Yeah. You know, seven years ago. That's what I wanted. And here we are.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it. This is what you should be doing.
Yeah, I'm doing it. I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
I think I've heard you talk about radical acceptance before.
Absolutely.
What
Absolutely.
Does that mean?
So actually my partner just posted this as well. Peace is acceptance. And radical acceptance and radical, and the big thing I talk about is radical responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
But radical acceptance is completely understanding where you are and being content in where you are, not complacent in where you are, not unwilling to change where you are, but to be fully okay. This is where I am in space and time. I can be here and I'm not going to judge it. It's not good or bad. This is where I am. And that's okay. But what are the next indicated steps? Radical responsibility is owning where you are, how you got there. Because the world's not happening to us. The world's happening for us, and the world's happening for us. So how do we get where we're to our destination now? And do we want to change it? And then we take full responsibility for the healing. So those are the things that I speak about quite a lot. It's the responsibility, but the acceptance, that's where the peace is found. Because for me, here was my experience. I wasn't one of those business owners that made successful money right away. I was broke for a long time. And I had to learn to be content without any contingencies. Content without any, just understand that, okay, trust God's timing. This is where I am. I know I'm putting the work in. I know I have good motives. I know I'm a good person. I know that I'm good in what I'm doing. It's just not it's not equaling dollars and cents right now. And that's okay. And being able to accept where I was able to find some solace in my mind and in my heart, understanding that, okay, I mean, I have everything that I want, but I accept that this is where I'm supposed to be right now. And I can keep doing the work, but there may not be much I can really change right now. So, you know, when we find ourselves in that acceptance, no matter what, we find ourselves with a little bit more peace. It's when we're restless, irritable, and discontent, trying to change everything, needing to change everything, is where we're wrestling with the world around us.
Yeah. Can I say you sound like Black Buddha?
Oh, do I? Thank you.
Like, it's a very Zen concept, like that peace with where you are right now and being okay with that. Accepting things as they are, not as you would have them be. And then that additional step where you said radical responsibility, owning where we are. Can you talk a little more about things don't happen to you, they happen for you?
Absolutely. My life, just about as tragic as it can get. I'm duly diagnosed, sexual trauma, racial trauma, violent history, almost went to prison, and a heroin addict and a sex addict. Just about every affliction that can go on, every trouble that could happen has happened. Besides losing my parents or losing a child, you know, mm-hmm. I've been divorced. I've just struggled. But it's all made me who I am today. The words that I'm saying right now are words that come from my experiences, and my experiences uniquely qualify me to help others. So life's happening to you if you're not finding purpose in your pain. But when you find pain in your purpose, when you find purpose in your pain, you are prepared to be of service to the world around you based on what you've experienced. A friend of mine is a womb coach, my partner actually. She works in the womb space. She works in womb health and women's health. And she had a tragic experience where she lost a baby. And it's just tragic. This is about just about one of the most tragic things that a woman can experience, right? As we all know. And I told her, I said, this is now when you're helping women heal their womb, this is just another piece of the puzzle that you can provide service and you could provide support. So all those tragedies that happen perceivably to our lives and to us can be shifted on their head and used to serve others. If you are invoked enough to do that. Some people don't want to, don't feel they can be of maximum service with their struggle, and they stay in a victim mentality. But if you shift it and say, okay, now I know better, now I can teach, now I can mentor, now I can do this with my, even doesn't have to be a coach. You can do this with your children. These are lessons you learn. So your children, you can shift the generation with things that have happened in your life. You can shift generational curses. Say, I know this happened to me. This happened to me. So now it's something that my child may not have to struggle through or suffer with. So it's all happening for you. Yes, like you didn't get that job. Yes, it wasn't for you. That job, there's a better opportunity for you. You know, the disappointments. Yes, it wasn't for you. Something better is there. How can I serve? And that's another way. That's another way to get out of yourself and to find yourself not suffering is to be into a place of like, how can I serve my community? You know, and I wasn't always like that. That's new to me. That's recently through some work I was doing, was I like, okay, I get to serve my freaking community and I get to like be of impact. And before, even though I was coaching, now I look on a more grand scale and on the podcast, it's like, these experiences can now be the permission for others to say, okay, me too. I can make it as well. There's hope, you know? So it's not, none of the stuff that happened in my life happened to me at all. Uniquely qualified me to serve.
Yeah. And I mean, like you said, the world needs more people like you leading the way that you are leading and being the example you are.
Thank you. That means the world.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts. This is really interesting and given me a lot to think about too. And I think it will help a lot of our listeners and especially our men who are listening. How can someone find you?
Everything that I do is on Eric_BigMoodCoach. That is my business card. That is my promo. You can find the podcast links there. You can find coaching offerings. You can find, we're putting some courses and some eBooks. You can find a link to my first workbook. You can find a link to everything that I've done and that I do is on that social media. And everything that's on my social media is a direct reflection of my life. There's no fluff there. It's where, there's no pretending. So you're getting me there, but it's Eric_BigMoodCoach. And then bigmoodcoach.com is the website, but we're shifting that around. But so Eric_BigMoodCoach is the best place to find everything about me, and go to Hearts Over Everything on Apple, Spotify, Podbean, everywhere, every platform, and YouTube, Big Mood TV. We have video of our podcast as well.
Well, that's great. And I'll put your Instagram, the @Eric_BigMood. Coach on the show notes so people can find you. I really awesome. Appreciate what you're doing. I love this conversation and I thank you so much for your time. And I can't wait to see what else you put out into the world.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Ashray.
Thank you, Eric.
Blessings. Take care.
Hey everyone, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Alcohol Tipping Point. I'm always here for you guys, so please feel free to reach out and talk to me on Instagram at Alcohol Tipping Point and check out my website, alcoholtippingpoint.com. Again, I hope you can use these tips we talked about for the rest of your week. And until then, see you next time.